listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and thanks for downloading Football in Europe. I'm Rob Daly. Both Chris and I have been away, so apologies for not giving you a show last week. Chris is still away, but don't worry, we have loads of great guests this week. La Liga does go to the final day. Spanish football writer Colin Miller joins us. Ben Arfa is potentially off to Barcelona. Mark Rodden from ESPN FC tells us about that. Richard Connolly, commentator on Sky Sports coverage of the Eredivisie, explains how PSV dramatically became champions on the final day. And Kevin Hatchard talks to us about Bayern finally clinching the title. But let's start with BT Sport commentator Steve Wyeth, and we're going to talk about Gonzalo Higuain. Steve, hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Nice to chat with you.
It's great to finally get you on, mate, because I've been meaning to get you on a lot this season. You cover so many European leagues for BT. So how about we do a bit of Serie A and French football?
That sounds perfect. Sounds perfect, Rob.
So on Sunday night, you were commentating on Napoli and the fact that they were able to get a 2-1 winner at Torino. Napoli holding on to that Champions League spot, that second Champions League spot anyway, which doesn't require a playoff. But all eyes on Gonzalo Higuain. Do you want to explain why?
Well, the title has gone now for Napoli, and they are in prime position to clinch the runners-up spot. And as you say, that £24 million prize that effectively is placed in the group stage in the Champions League. They certainly won't want to go through the playoff round because they lost the last time they ended up in that situation. So a lot of the focus now is whether Gonzalo Higuain can break this 66-year-old Serie A goal-scoring record. It's held by Gunnar Nordahl, who scored 35 goals in a season for AC Milan in 1949-1950. That's the post-war Italian flight record. And Higuain, with the goal he scored against Torino on Sunday night, is now just two behind it. So two goals on the final day, and let's be honest, that is far from beyond Gonzalo Higuain, would see him equal one of the most prestigious records in all of Italian football.
And Steve, if he hadn't got that recent suspension, he would have had a few more games when he sort of flipped out in that match and got himself a red card. I mean, he probably would have had a better chance to break the record as well.
Yeah, well, bearing in mind, I think in the last 13 games that he's played in the league, he's scored 14 goals, Rob. That gives you an indication of just how critical the three games he was suspended for following the sending off at Udinese could be. I mean, he won't want to be wondering what might have been come the end of the season and just how much that might have cost him a place in Italian footballing folklore. They have Frosinone on the final day. Frosinone are relegated. Napoli need the 3 points to ensure that they do clinch second spot ahead of Roma. So all of the indications are there that it could be a goal-scoring evening for Higuain on Saturday night. He had three efforts on goal, saved by Padelli in the Torino goal on Sunday night. So he had to make do with the one against Torino. He'll need at least two against Frosinone on the final day.
To partly put it in perspective for listeners, to list some players who haven't come close to breaking this record in recent years but have finished top scorer in Serie A: Shevchenko, Crespo, Christian Vieri, Luca Toni, including last season, Totti, Del Piero, Ibrahimovic, Di Natale, Cavani and Ciro Immobile. I mean, how has Gonzalo Higuain been so good this season, Steve? Because he was under Rafa Benitez last year. Obviously Mauricio Sarri this season. Do you think the coach has been a big factor in this?
Undoubtedly, Maurizio Sarri's attention to detail has worked in favour for the like, not just the Gonzalo Higuain. You look at the performances we've seen from Hamsik and Callejon, Insigne as well. They all seem to have been revitalised. And something that Sarri has put in place is, we talk about tinkermen managers who can never quite make their mind up what their best 11 is or what the best tactics are. Sarri made his mind up at the beginning of the season. Of the 11 players who started the game against Torino on Sunday night, Koulibaly, at the centre of defence, who made 31 league appearances, that was the fewest of that starting 11. That is about as settled a team as you will find in any of European football. So that gives the team the opportunity to click. And when Gonzalo Higuain hits a rich vein of running form, he can be pretty certain he's going to get the service. And one-on-one in front of goal, there are a few better. So providing chances are being created, he's going to take them.
And do you think Napoli will hold on to that second Champions League spot? Stephen goes straight into the group stage. They're 2 points ahead of Roma.
Yeah, Roma have got a really, really tough final day by comparison. They play AC Milan, who are still, of course, fighting for a place in the Europa League next season. So that's a game that they need to win as well. So having got themselves back in front, Napoli, and with the easier of the two final day games, I think it will be Napoli joining Juventus in the group stage of the Champions League for next season, and Roma will need to go through the playoffs.
And Steve, really, you've been across teams trying to qualify for the Champions League this weekend, so let's talk about the fact that you commentated on a second versus third in Liga on Saturday night, Lyon-Monaco. Lyon winning 6-1. What on earth happened there?
Well, I've had quite a good weekend, Rob. I think I've had about €60 million worth of football matches to watch in terms of the prizes at stake. Yeah, I mean, this was billed as effectively the game of the season in France. I don't know whether you saw the comments of Jean-Michel Houllier, the Lyon president, who said in the week that PSG were champions of Qatar. The game between Lyon and Monaco was for the championship of France. It was very tongue-in-cheek. He quickly backpedaled and said he was joking. I wonder whether he might get a bit of a frosty reception next time Lyon are away to PSG.
I suspect.
Yeah, it was a hugely significant game because effectively, over the course of the last couple of months, Lyon have reeled in 9 points in 9 places on Monaco, and they were level pegging going into Saturday night's game at Parc OL. So it was really set up to be a winner-takes-all kind of occasion. And whoever won that game was joining PSG in the Champions League next season. So you thought it was going to be edgy, it was going to be tight, there was going to be plenty of anxiety around the place. Not a bit of it. Lyon, who have been on this tremendous run of form, came out absolutely flying, scored early through the outstanding Gazelle, scored 3 more times before half-time. Lassina Traoré of Monaco was sent off for 2 yellow cards in the space of 2 minutes. It was weapons-grade stupidity on such a big occasion. And although they got one back just before the break, Lyon scored twice more in the second half. They weren't quite as rampant then, but it was a phenomenal performance. And bearing in mind the pressure they would have been under, they really delivered where it mattered.
Steve, thank you very much. Let's stay with French football. We'll also be discussing Belgian football too with ESPN FC correspondent Mark Rodden.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
Right, joining me now from Belgian Pro League World Feed headquarters, it's Mark Rodden. Mark, hello.
Hello, unspecified location.
We can't reveal it, but we're in an intimate cabin to talk about Belgian and French football. Let's start with the French team of the year, because that has been announced, and just dominated by PSG players.
8 PSG players, the back four, Blaise Matuidi, Marco Verratti, Angel Di Maria and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. The only players from other clubs, Steve Mandanda in goal, Lassana Diarra in midfield, Hatem Ben Arfa in attack. Don't think many people will argue with that lineup. Weird to see 2 Marseille players in it after their terrible season, but maybe they'll save it by winning the cup final against PSG on May 21st.
Let's talk about Ben Arfa, because you commentated on what it was, his final home game potentially.
I think definitely it's just a case of where he's going. Obviously rumours during the week that he was going to go to Barcelona. The first talk was that Barcelona were looking for someone to replace bolster their attack, give a break to Messi, Neymar and Suarez. Felt they were maybe overworked during the season. Lacazette was talked about. Kevin Gamero has been talked about. Then on Friday, I think it was, L'Equipe had the story that Ben Arfa was in advanced negotiations. Nice's president came out and said Ben Arfa had said, yeah, that's true. So apparently now he's travelling to Barcelona to have a look around. He's hardly going to turn up his nose at the facilities and the city. So if it is true, yeah, it's one of the most spectacular comebacks in football. You know, from Newcastle and Hull reject to a Barcelona player in the space of a year, having spent 6 months without a club last season, fallen foul of the FIFA rules that stop you playing for 3 clubs in a year. He wanted to sign for Nice in January 2015. He couldn't, so he just played a bit of futsal with his mates. Then came back, scored 17 goals, made 5 more. Nice, another great win over Saint-Étienne on Saturday. They're up to 4th in the table, assured of at least a Europa League place next season. If they might be making a movie about Hatem Ben Arfa, you know, if it wasn't for Leicester. But yeah, he's been exceptional. You know, he wasn't at his best on Saturday. Maybe the rumours affected him a little bit. But hopefully for Nice, Saint-Étienne got 2 players off and sent off rather in fairly comical circumstances. Kevin Malcuy sent off for 2 yellows in 2 minutes. And a rather out of shape, Franck Tabanou. Didn't play much for Swansea back at Saint-Étienne. Down to 10 men, he decided to have a wild swipe at Jeremy Piet, and Nice broke through 11 against 9, 1-2-0.
I think when you see Ben Arfa now, you can see how sharp he is, because his turns and his skills are in... I mean, I don't think I've seen anyone almost as sharp in Europe this season. And you can see a physical difference in him, obviously compared to the shape he was in England. So what do you think has happened? Is that him personally taking on a decision? Look, I'm late 20s now. I don't know if he's 29 now.
He's
even
29. Yeah.
29. So do you think he took it upon himself to the club? Was it a joint effort? I mean, what do you think's happened with Ben Arfa?
Like anything, you know, he had time off, had time to reflect. He's talked a lot about Claude Puel, the Nice manager, that, you know, he was a big influence, and Puel said, look, he's not really, you know, he has a reputation as a problematic
bad boy.
Just said he's not really. He's just, you know, like any other player, you just need to manage him. And, you know, once he got a bit of confidence, it was actually against Saint-Étienne before Christmas that he really caught the eye with a couple of spectacular goals. Interesting just seeing him against Saint-Étienne, just three or four players drawn to him every time. Maybe I'm being a bit harsh saying he didn't have his best game. It was hard. You know, there was a lot of players coming to him. If he moves to a better club, he's going to get space. He's going to get, you know, more room to work with. He's still scoring goals. He's still creating goals. I think before last night, he'd made 7 out of 8 of Nice's last goals at home, either scored them or made them. Just an incredible form. Recall to the France squad. And Didier Deschamps is naming his Euro 2016 squad on Thursday.
Ah, right, I didn't know that.
Where do you start? I mean,
well, for playmakers, I mean, you know, those number 10 guys, he's got them by the droves, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, people talking about missing Benzema. Lacazette now on 21 goals for the season, 15.
After a slow start.
Six before Christmas and 15 after. Camaro, what's he got, 26 goals or something? Or over 20 anyway.
Yeah, all comps are outrageous, yeah.
And he's not even in the squad. Now there's Lacazette. It's a toss-up whether Ben... You know, it was until the last few weeks whether Ben Arfa would make it. And then, obviously, if guys like Payet and the likes of them coming back, Kingsley Coman...
And Martial actually come into the fore this year for the national team. I mean, do you think there's no chance for Nabil Fekir? Is it too late after he's come back from injury?
Yeah, I think it's too late. And
it's too late, right.
It's too late because just the form of the other guys who aren't in the squad. So for Fekir, yeah, I think it's too late for him. But Gazette, I don't know.
Maybe.
Camero, one of them.
Before we talk about Belgium, the talk about Ousmane Dembele at the moment is rife. He's performing very well at Rennes. He's 18, I want to say. He's still only 18. I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But the Dortmund link very heavy and linked with Leicester City this week. Why should people who haven't seen him yet be excited about Dembele?
He's a guy who just signed his first professional contract in October, I think it was. 12 goals, 5 assists. Just really exciting. Just, you know, that's a young kid coming into a team, just taking them by storm. In fairness, I think all this speculation has affected him the last few weeks. He's been stuck on 12 goals for a while. A lot expected of him. Rennes kind of dropping down the table a little bit. Even talk of Dembele making the Euro 2016 squad, which is a bit ridiculous considering he hadn't played for France under 21s. And just the list of scouts, you know, Barcelona, Dortmund, you know, Bayern Munich, all the clubs, all the English clubs involved as well, looking out for him. And this is from before Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just think if someone's able to do that in a mid-table French team, in a league that's not known for goal scoring either, you know, that's known for being tactical and tight, and he's just carrying a team single-handedly, then it's kind of scary how good he's going to be.
Let's talk about Belgium, because it's all going off this afternoon. You're in front of the abacus and the computers all blowing up because Belgium's complicated. As you brilliantly explained on the show before, people absolutely loved your description of how the Belgian league works. So how are things looking at the moment? Because Club Brugge look in the best position, although not much in it, to win the title.
Yeah, Anderlecht winning early on Sunday. A bit fortunate. They were very poor in the first half against Oostende, who were fifth in the table. Passed off the park, really. You know, that game had everything. It had Oostende have a very colourful goalkeeper, Gabon international called Didier Avono. They conceded a penalty. Yuri Tielemans stepped up day after his 19th birthday, scored it to equalise, was then really forcefully shoved into the net by Avono as he went to collect the ball. A few minutes later, Ivano came out with a two-footed tackle. No penalty, amazingly, and he had been booked for the shove earlier, so it would have been a unique sending off, I think. Certainly, it was the first time I've ever seen a two-footed tackle from a goalkeeper. And then they kind of huffed and puffed. They were a lot better in the second half. Got a 94th-minute winner through Stefano Okaka, 14th goal of the season for him, former Sampdoria man. So they grind out another win, and you're going Bruges are playing Ghent. Ghent's last chance, really, defending champions, six points behind Bruges, the league leaders, and Bruges kind of blew them away. Got a little lucky, fell behind, got back into it. Hans van Aken with a couple of goals. I think he's got 7 after Christmas, and that's not even starting talking about his assists. He's been really, really good. Brought in from Lokeren. They sold Victor Vasquez to Cruz Azul of Mexico over the winter, and it's really freed up van Aken. And Jose Izquierdo, a Colombian, really special talent as well, whose progress has been badly disrupted by injuries. He's just come into form finally at the end of the season in the playoffs, and he tore Ghent to shreds. So Bruges will be 3 points ahead.
I mean, do you think Bruges are they're the best team in the league, though, that they... I mean, everyone saw Ghent this season do very well in the Champions League and only get knocked out in the round of 16 by Wolfsburg. But do you think Club Bruges are the best side in the league? Because I thought they played really great football under Michel Preud'homme last season.
Yeah, they did. And they got to the Europa League quarterfinals and just ran out of steam.
That's exactly it. It was just too much for them, the amount of games and everything.
Yeah, exactly. They had a great season and won the Cup, which was significant. First time they'd won a trophy in 8 years. But just lost again with 3 games to go, and it was snatched from them almost. And, you know, Ghent were brilliant after that. 2015, put it this way, Ghent were spectacular. And a similar thing has happened to them this season. They just looked tired and had a really bad run since February. And Bruges have been inconsistent at times, but definitely playing some of the best football, scoring lots of goals. They played Manchester United in the Champions League qualifiers. That wasn't a fair reflection at all because they had you know, a whole team out injured, basically. So I think they'll deserve it if they win it.
And can you explain why, if Anderlecht and Club Bruges finish on the same amount of points at the end of the season, that Club Bruges will win the title no matter of goal difference? Because it's very odd in Belgium how it works.
Yeah, so the points are split at the end of, or halved rather, at the end of the regular season. So Club Bruges finished the regular season top. That's the best way of explaining it. They finished the regular season top, so that kind of gives them an advantage, that the team that wins the regular season, if it's level on points, should win the league. But they had more points, the half-point rule.
It's going to give everyone a headache.
Yeah, they had more points after the regular season. So so Anderlecht are 3 points behind. So even if they beat Bruges next weekend in the big match with 3 games to go, they'll still be behind them, no matter what the goal difference. And that's before getting into the final European place, because the Europa League playoff two group winners play off against each other, two-legged tie from next week for the right to play fourth in a two-legged tie for a Europa League place.
Does even anyone in Belgium know what's going on? I'm sure they don't.
The last European place is funny because I think the last game of the season for them will be on May 29th, and if they get through, their first game, I think, is going to be something like July 12th.
Right, yeah, second qualifying round, yes, or something is around then.
Is it worth it? I don't think so, you know.
Mark, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
No worries.
This is Football in Europe, La Liga latest.
And a big thanks to Mark Rodden for coming back on the show. Always great to talk about French football and Belgian football with him as well. Let's talk about La Liga now, because the title race and the battle to survive is going down to the final day. Spanish football expert Colin Miller is here. Colin, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Mate, so much to get through here on your first appearance on the podcast, which we really appreciate. Let's talk about Atletico losing to bottom-placed Levante, who were, you know, already down 2-1. It means Atletico cannot win the title. So, I saw Diego Simeone say we're actually in front in that game. So what happened?
Yes, well, they took the lead in the opening 2 minutes. Fernando Torres, who's on a remarkable run of form, really. Everybody has sort of written him off as being dead and buried. And if anything, it was, you know, Diego Simeone. He's turned so many players' careers on its head. But nobody really thought he could do it with Torres yet. You know, that's another success story. Obviously back at the Calderon. He gave him the lead again after 2 minutes. And really at that point, you kind of saw, you know, Levante, bottom of the table, they're already down. It could turn into 2 or 3-0, especially if Atletico goes strong. It's such a strong defensive record. And actually going into this game, that didn't happen. About half an hour in, Victor Caceres equalised. You know, Atletico were hanging on a wee bit. They looked a little bit fatigued. Obviously, they had their European exploits at Bayern in the week. In the dying seconds, they lost it. Giuseppe Rossi, and he was a big January signing for Levante. And really, they sort of pinned their hopes of staying up on him. It didn't materialise, but he grabbed the late winner. And even though they are going down, that will be a memorable win for their fans. And obviously a very damaging win for Atletico. It drove them out of the title race. Well, Real Madrid didn't pick up a comfortable home win. They edged out Valencia. And Barcelona breezed past Espanyol in the Catalan derby. But the real caveat here is that Real Madrid, Deportivo, and Barcelona, Granada, both those teams are safe. They are officially safe. They have nothing whatsoever to play for. And there's a real sort of sense that, you know, these could potentially be two very comfortable victories for both Barcelona and Real, which would, of course, mean a Barcelona title. Barcelona, first of all, they're at Granada. And Granada, really, they've sort of got a bit of a reputation of being the Spanish Sunderland, so to speak. They struggle all season long. They make maybe a managerial change January, February, and they pick up maybe around mid-March onwards an inexplicable run of good form. You know, they would like to say that not only have they stayed up, but they've also influenced the destination of La Liga title.
So the upshot is that if Real Madrid have to win and Barcelona have to not win for Real Madrid to win the title, because of head-to-head, isn't it? So if they finish level on points, Barcelona would still win the league, regardless of goal difference.
The only hiccup, of course, which recently when Barcelona went on three league defeats on the bounce, obviously they crashed out of the Champions League in that spell as well. And people did question them, which was obviously legitimate. But having said that, their run-in is straightforward. You know, since that defeat at home to Valencia, which in itself was seen as a relatively straightforward game at the time, but since that, they've been playing teams in the bottom half, mainly with nothing to play for, and they've racked up on those, I think it's 4 games since they racked up an aggregate score of 21 goals scored and none conceded, which is, you know, it's barbaric, really. In Barcelona, there were signs, as I said, signs about a month ago that the fatigue was starting to kick in. It's a small squad, and it has been stretched this year, but they've clicked again, they've refound their form, and they're looking pretty unstoppable at the moment, it has to be said. And again, going into the final day, they're 1 point ahead of Real Madrid. Real Madrid as well, they're away to Deportivo. Deportivo have not been on a great run recently. They won away to Villarreal at the weekend. It was their first victory in a few months, and haven't been flying high in the first half of the season. They've really crashed.
Colin, in terms of in the derby of the weekend, Barcelona beat Espanyol 5-0, their city rivals. In the past year in particular, this is a derby that has certainly got a bit more feisty. Would that be fair to say?
Oh, yes, Sam, definitely. I mean, this is always a game where there's a lot of bad feeling historically. Obviously, you know, Catalan rivals. And, you know, obviously there's a little bit of an inferiority complex with Espanyol, as it would be almost any other side when you're comparing yourself to Barcelona. Now, Espanyol, again, haven't had a great season. They've probably, if anything, surpassed expectations and stayed up. I don't think anybody really rates their team overly highly, but I think that the rivalry really started cooking again in the earlier half of the season in the return match at Espanyol. It finished 0-0. And it was a pretty brutal affair in terms of the tactics employed by Espanyol. Now, they did work in terms of they got the result, and they riled up Barcelona, which some people would argue isn't the hardest thing in the world to do. But there's a lot of bad feeling. I think there's a few personal duels between the players as well, especially between Suarez and Messi in particular. They were targeting them, trying to, you know, a lot of niggly files, a little sort of stamps and things off the ball, which maybe Suarez isn't totally you know, unfamiliar with. I think sometimes they allow their emotions to get a little bit too strong in that first game. But yesterday it was totally different. Messi gave them the lead after 8 minutes with a wonderful free kick. And really from there, it was it was almost game over. Nobody really expected Espanyol to come back. The record at Camp Nou is atrocious. And Barcelona ran out 5-0 winners, 4 of the goals coming after halftime. Suarez scored 2, Rafinha and Neymar scored later on as well. And that was a very, very comfortable win. And then they've announced today that both those matches, both the Real Madrid game at Depor and Barca's game at Granada, they're going to run simultaneously as expected. I think it's 5 o'clock next Saturday afternoon. And then the relegation battle will be decided the following day with 3 simultaneous matches.
Colin, just a quick one to finish on the relegation fight, because do you want to just give people an idea? You mentioned there Levante down despite the signing of Giuseppe Rossi. So who is in a precarious situation at the moment going into the final day?
Well, Levante already relegated, as I said, despite that victory. So that leaves, and Granada are safe. So that leaves 3 teams who are still in the battle, and there's 2 spaces for them to go down.
Right.
But it's 3 teams. It's intriguing, very intriguing. Getafe are currently safe. They're on 36 points. Sporting Gijon are below them on head-to-head. They're also on 36. And Rayo Vallecano, the team from Vallecas in Madrid, are on 35 points. So they're a point behind. So Rayo are at home to Levante next week in a game they're expected to win. Now, the 2 other games, Getafe travel to Real Betis. So if you're looking for predictions, I think Rayo are going to win at home to Levante. But I don't think it's going to be enough to keep them up, sadly. I think they're sort of a second team of many La Liga fans, just because they've operated for 4 or 5 years at the top flight on a budget of virtually zero. They're getting by on freebies, on loan deals, and it's remarkable. Not that the style of play that Paco James plays, and he's tipped the lead in the summer, regardless of whether they stay up or not. So that's going to be a shame, but you know that's just the way it is. They're going to be a loss to La Liga, but I think they will go. Sporting, it only takes one of Sporting or Getafe to win to relegate Rayo. I think Sporting will probably beat Villarreal at home. It's a big call, but I think in terms of the situation and the context, I think they'll edge it. Getafe, I could see joining Rayo in Segunda next year. Trip to Betis, as I said, I don't fancy them doing that. I just don't think they've got enough firepower up front, and they'll probably see it out in front of their home fans in the final day of the season. So as I said, Getafe and Rayo, the two sort of smaller clubs of Madrid, the lesser known clubs, they're probably gonna be relegated along with Levante.
Colin, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week.
Lovely to be on, Rob. Thanks very much.
Okay, next we're going to talk German football. On Saturday night, I caught up with a Bundesliga commentator, Kevin Hatchard, to discuss Bayern winning the title, Guardiola, the future of Mats Hummels, Gladbach claiming 4th, and the relegation fight. Forgive the background noise as well. We record this on Saturday night at Cologne Airport.
This is Football in Europe, Bundesliga Roundup.
Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be back. I thought we weren't going to get through security, but we finally made it. It was all a bit stressful in the end, wasn't it?
Annoyed me. And what was good was that I got to press the little angry red face through the terminal. You pressed it a couple of times as well.
I pressed it in solidarity with you, because you got shouted at.
Shouted at twice. So I commentated on Gladbach beating Leverkusen today, basically booking them into the Champions League. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But you commentated on Schalke Augsburg. So Schalke going into today, one of 4 teams that could still grab that last Champions League spot. Bayern, Dortmund and Leverkusen already qualified. And Schalke did their best to muck it up.
Kind of typical of their season, really, Rob, because they had an opportunity. They knew that if they'd won the game, it would have taken it right to the final weekend of the season. They were 1-0 up against Augsburg going into the last couple of minutes and conceded a goal that was very well finished by Daniel Bayer, but eminently preventable. And it's the kind of mental lapse they've had all season. They've never really found their consistency under Andre Breitenreiter. I think once again, we saw his tactical limitations. They were far too passive. They've got some really good attacking players in there, but they just really struggled to break Augsburg down. And did they deserve to win? I'm not sure they did.
It has been a very strange season for Schalke, because I think there was hope after Roberto Di Matteo had brought a rather boring brand of football. Would that be fair to Schalke?
Yeah.
that maybe something would be different. Why hasn't it worked? Because I think football fans in England in particular would look at the names that have been linked with, you know, we're talking about young, really talented young players like Leroy Sané, linked with Manchester City, and Max Meyer, who's been linked with the Premier League as well.
I think Andre Breitenreiter had done well with Paderborn to take them up. I think he'd had a really good go at keeping them up last season. He only narrowly missed out. They lost to Stuttgart on the final day. He wasn't Schalke's first choice for the job, and I think he was slightly in over his head. I think the one positive you would say is that he managed to unite the dressing room. Schalke usually riven by dressing room problems and outbursts and leaks, but this time it wasn't like that. But I think, again, when they were in tight games and they needed a bit of tactical acumen to get them through those, he wasn't able to come up with it. And ultimately, he knew towards the end of the season that he was probably going. I'd be amazed if he is kept on beyond the summer. I'm pretty sure he's going to go.
I mean, you were already speaking about him. I don't know if you realised in the past tense, as if he had already gone, because that's the way the media are talking at the moment.
Yeah, and he admitted himself a few weeks ago that he wasn't sure of his future. And for a coach to be saying that in his very first season, you know, that smacks of somebody who doesn't feel he's supported at the highest level. It's going to be a summer of change for them anyway, because Christian Heidel's coming in, the sporting director from Mainz. He's one of the best in the business. I think he will want his own man. That could be Marcus Weinziel from Augsburg, or it could be somebody else.
So for Augsburg today, there was nothing at play and they got their last minute equaliser. And so the irony being that Weinziel, the very manager that Breitenreiter came up against today, has stopped him getting into the Champions League, and maybe stopped his own club that he takes charge of next season being in the Champions League.
He may well have done. Augsburg knew they might need a result. As it turned out, they didn't, because of results elsewhere. But what they've done is they found their form at the right time. They've taken 11 points from their last five matches. They found a determination in defence that wasn't there earlier in the season. And what Weinziel's very, very good at is maximising his resources. He's a good motivator, but he's got that tactical ability to change games. He said that he wants to leave. I think Gladbach might have been an option for him if they hadn't made the top four and they maybe got rid of Andre Schubert. It now looks likely that he's on his way to Schalke. And I think with the young players they've got there, there's every chance that he'll do well there. I think two of the big factors for Schalke this season, one was injuries. They didn't have Benedikt Hervidas for a lot of the campaign, and they lacked that defensive solidity that he can bring. And they also missed Mateo Nastasic for the entire season. He was injured on the very first weekend of the season against Werder Bremen, and that was him done for the whole campaign.
Say Schalke had won today and they came very close, it would have been...
They'd have been a point behind. They were a point behind going into the game. Gladbach, as we'll talk about in a bit, won. So they'd have been right in there, and it would have set up a great final game, actually, because they'd have gone to Hoffenheim. Effectively, they've blown it. It was a really big opportunity for them, even though they've been poor towards the end of the season. I mean, that's now 4 wins out of 13, and that ain't Champions League qualification form.
So today I did a Gladbach against Bayer Leverkusen. Last weekend, Leverkusen qualified for the Champions League by beating Hertha, so they're guaranteed third no matter what, and largely down, people have seen, to the goals of Javier Hernandez in particular this season. So they brought 15 players. Did I tell you about this? They brought 15 players to the game. That's all they had. They had four subs today because they said we had players out through illness. Campbell and Brandt had flu. Their whole back line's injured. Three of their back four are actually listed as midfielders on the club website today. But they gave it a go. They actually took the lead. Charles Aranguiz gave Leverkusen the lead. But then Andre Hahn turned it around with two goals. Gladbach are basically in the Champions League. They'd need to lose like 11-0 on the final day.
Well, he is a great example of what could have been, in a way, for Gladbach if they'd had their players fit all season. If you look at what they've done since Schubert took charge, he took charge of a team, let's not forget, that didn't have a point from the first five match days. He's managed to get them playing really, really strongly at home. The away form is something he's going to have to look at long term. But they've had Martin Stransel out, their veteran defender, pretty much the whole season. They've had Tony Janschke out for a big chunk of the season. Alvaro Dominguez has been out. So Andreas Christensen on loan from Chelsea has had to really step up and has done so. And so with all of those injury problems, Hahn out as well. So with all of those players Patrick Herrmann for a big chunk of the season. Yeah. So these are... And Gladbach traditionally, certainly over the past few seasons under Favre and then under Schubert, have run off a very tight, very small squad. And so they're not really built to cope with that many injuries. So you have to give credit to the guys who've had to really rack up the games in the absences of the others. And they lost two massive players in the summer as well. They lost Max Kruse to Wolfsburg, and they lost Christoph Kramer when he went back after his loan spell and went back to Bayer Leverkusen. So you've lost a midfield engine and a really creative talent in attack, and yet they've qualified for the Champions League again. So Andre Schubert deserves all the plaudits for managing to do that, which is why I think he'll keep the job. I think it was close. I think if they hadn't got the top four, he might have been in danger. But I think they'll stick with him now.
What was interesting today was you mentioned Christoph Kramer, the player who famously went off with a concussion in the World Cup final and doesn't remember playing for Germany in that game. He was on a two-year loan at Gladbach and is now at Leverkusen. And he actually went back to Borussia Park for the first time today. And against Mahmoud Dahoud, who's been one of the finds of the season, isn't he? Just been wonderful.
Oh, sensational.
Dahoud bossed him. And I don't know, I've not seen whether Kramer had an injury, but they took him off at half-time. Such was the extent it appeared that Dahoud was winning the 50-50s and getting there ahead of him. Dahoud's an interesting story in himself, this sort of Syrian-born, very silky-looking football player. Could you compare him to... I'm struggling to think of anyone you could compare him to, because he's not just a silky passer. He's been linked with Premier League clubs, but he drives play forward.
Yeah, he does. And he is somebody who is prepared to win the ball in midfield as well. He's not scared of a challenge, but he is primarily an attacking midfielder. He has great awareness of what weight to put on a pass, and he scores goals as well. And I think what's great about him is he's fearless. He started this season as an impact sub under Lucien Favre, and as soon as Andre Schubert was promoted from the reserves, he'd worked with Dahoud quite a lot, and he knew that he could put him straight in.
Yeah.
And I think he scored on his full debut against Augsburg in the first game, and he's gone from strength to strength. And it's no surprise that he's one of the names that's been mentioned now that Ilkay Gundogan's out for Germany in the Euros, because if he can play at that level at the Bundesliga already, there's no reason he couldn't make the step up to international football.
Bayern are champions.
Yeah, and deservedly so. People will talk a lot, and I understand why, about whether Pep Guardiola has been a failure at Bayern because he hasn't won the Champions League. And it does tarnish the legacy, if you like, slightly, that he hasn't been able to at least get them to a final in that competition. But the one thing he's done, which is really admirable, is he's made the incredible seem routine in the Bundesliga. They have won the league every single season he's been there, and you now get the impression, or people get the impression, that it's a really easy league to win. It's not. In the last decade, you've had Stuttgart win it, you've had Borussia Dortmund win it, you've had Wolfsburg win it. Bayern have never before won four titles in a row. They won as part of the treble under Jupp Heynckes, and they've now won 3 years in a row under Guardiola. That is, whichever way you look at it, an amazing achievement, and even more so this season, because Borussia Dortmund have been superb.
The conception that the Bundesliga is easy or a one-team league is a complete myth, because prior to Guardiola taking over, Bayern had won three of the previous seven Bundesliga titles, and you actually mentioned quite a few of the guys who, including Klopp's Dortmund, of course, in that time, and Dortmund have been outrageously good this season. The other thing is, I don't know why people want it to be so black and white, because the thing is, people love this, and you mentioned it there, the success or failure thing, right? In Oktoberfest, when all the Bayern fans are having a beer reflecting on the first 2 months of Ancelotti and the 3 years of Guardiola, they'll go, wasn't that great?
It's quite pertinent that you mention Ancelotti, because what you'll find is that Ancelotti will hugely benefit from the groundwork that Guardiola has done, because he has taken some of those players and improved them immeasurably.
On an individual level, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Jerome Boateng, I would argue, when Guardiola took over, a very good defender, prone to the odd mistake. Now I think he's arguably the best centre-back in Europe. And I think a lot of the players under Guardiola have made big strides, and they are interchangeable in terms of positions. Thomas Müller's put in his best ever season in the Bundesliga. He, I think, has made big strides. And I think that fluidity that he's brought to Bayern and that ability to adapt to different situations has made them much, much better players.
So a win at Ingolstadt today, won Bayern the title with a game to spare. And we'll talk about Dortmund in a second, because they did lose to Frankfurt, bizarrely. Back to Bayern very briefly. Lewandowski has slowed down in terms of goal rate. I looked at the first half of the season, scoring much more freely. I think he did score against Atletico, but he didn't look 100% sharp. I've not seen how he performed today in the win against Ingolstadt, because he did score. But do you think has he looked a little burnt out for you, or is it a case of the normal dips in form of a centre forward?
There have been games where I don't think Bayern needed to play him or start him, and they have, and I've been surprised by that, because even though I know he's going for the top scorer title, I know that no striker ever wants to be dropped.
But is that a credit to Dortmund putting the squeeze on Bayern in every league game, to the point where Guardiola didn't feel comfortable playing? I don't know, he doesn't even have a Claudio Pizarro type figure at the moment, does he, at their Bayern? But you know what I mean, like a third choice striker.
Yeah, they don't have that. I think Müller can play that role.
So who's going down, Kev?
It is a really tough one, because Werder are obviously Stuttgart. I think I can't see them getting that final win the way they're playing. I think it's 2 points from 8 games now. They've absolutely gone in terms of morale. I mean, they've panicked and they've gone. So I'll be very surprised if they get the win they need. And then it comes down to Werder, whether they can beat Frankfurt or not. Yeah. Maybe, even though for all I said about Niko Kovac and for all that they've improved,
they're going down.
They might be in that playoff spot, because Werder in their last 2 home games have blitzed teams. They beat Wolfsburg 3-2. They absolutely hammered Stuttgart. And for all their defensive issues, they do score goals and they do have firepower. In a way, it's better for them that they know they need to win.
Final one that I forgot to ask you about, Mats Hummels. So we're now probably a week or so on from, maybe a bit longer, from Dortmund releasing a statement that he wanted to head to Bayern and Bayern would have to pay the right money for him. Hummels was booed last weekend by the home fans, and he was fairly hurt, I think, by the nature of that Dortmund statement. Do you think it's going to happen regardless now?
Do you know what? I genuinely don't know, because the whole thing has been such a farce. What I don't understand, I can understand Hummels wanting to go back to Bayern. He's a Munich boy. He has links there. He has family in Munich. There's a sense of unfinished business to an extent. What has hurt him with the Dortmund fans is that he's made quite outspoken statements about, oh, players shouldn't go to Bayern, you know, it's a shame when they do, you know, it'd be nice if Bayern, you know, weren't so dominant, what have you.
It means more if you win a title here than there.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's really damaged him in the eyes of the Dortmund fans. And that's a real shame, because he's been a great servant to them. You know, he's shared with the Dortmund fans their best years in this golden era that they've found. And I think it's all ending in a very unseemly way. Bayern want him, there's no question about that. Whether they're prepared to pay what Dortmund want for him is a whole nother matter. But say Bayern are willing to play the long game and they're willing to let him see out the last year of his contract, that could be unbearable, because the Dortmund fans will know that he's going, Hummels will know that he's going, and that's a very unsatisfactory situation.
Lewandowski wasn't too different, I suppose.
I think the Lewandowski thing maybe doesn't hurt as much. Firstly, Firstly, he's not the captain.
No.
Secondly, it was kind of obvious what was happening, and Lewandowski hadn't made any statements to the contrary. He'd never said, oh, I would never join Bayern, or and that's kind of the impression that Hummels has given. So I think for so many reasons, it kind of bites a bit. And maybe as well because he's a German international as well, and I think that might bite a bit too. I think there's a certain pride amongst Dortmund fans that they've got such a prominent German international leading their team.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
Okay, to finish off the show now, we're joined by Eredivisie commentator. You might hear him on Sky Sports as well, Richard Connolly. Richard, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Very welcome, Rob. Good to be here.
You join us from Rome Airport.
Yeah, the life of a sort of multi-sports journalist, really. I'm off to cover the tennis. My football commitments have nearly finished for the season. I am actually going to be covering the Eredivisie European playoffs a little bit later on, the week after next. But for the time being, I've got some Rome Masters to get my teeth into. So, yeah, it's a bit of a confusing time in my brain, to be honest.
Before the confusion really sets in, let's talk about PSV winning the title. I mean, I remember we saw each other in the week, Richard, actually, covering the Champions League, and we were both of the mindset that PSV had no chance. Both PSV and Ajax were level on points. Ajax were playing one of the worst teams in the league in De Graafschap. But PSV are champions. How on earth did this happen?
Yeah, I mean, I thought their chance had gone as well. And actually, I think the PSV fans really in their heart of hearts thought their chance had gone because in penultimate round of games, they played Cambuur at home. Cambuur, bottom of the table, really the worst team, the worst defence. And you thought, well, they might score 8 or 9 goals in this game and they could actually feasibly catch Ajax up on goal difference and be champions even if Ajax won their remaining games. But PSV won that game 6-2 and Ajax won 4-0 at the same time. So the 6-2 win for PSV actually ended up feeling like a disappointment, which was quite unusual in itself. Right. So we came to the final weekend with PSV away to Peck Zwolle, which, as you rightly say, is a more difficult game, undoubtedly. They're in the top half than De Graafschap away. They had nothing left to play for and were going to be in the relegation playoffs come what may. And the simple truth to the matter has to be that Ajax just blew it on the last day. They were a goal up in the first half and conceded about 10 minutes into the second. A midfield player called Brian Smeets, who'd never scored in the Eredivisie before, but finished very nicely from the edge of the box. And it was one of those days where, you know, I guess these days it's smartphones, not transistor radios, but the PSV fans, there were about 500 of them in Zwolle, were all sort of listening in, crowding around the guy with the earphone in, trying to get updates, tapping away at their smartphones to see what had happened. And then there was this ripple that went round, and we were told in our commentary position, yeah, De Graafschap had equalised. And myself and Tony Cascarino, who were doing the game, we both got chills at that moment. And there was this little reverberation in the ground. And it, immediately that transmitted itself to the players because the game changed completely. PSV were attacking. They were winning 3-1. And all of a sudden it was, oh my, we might actually win the title. We better just hold on to what we have a little bit, which they did successfully. And then at the end of the game, there was another delay because inevitably PSV's game finished before Ajax's by about 2 minutes. And we're getting news through, yeah, there's going to be an extra minute. There's an extra minute on top of that. And PSV players themselves were then crowded around somebody with a phone and with some information coming through. And they're all asking each other, have we done it? Have we done it? Have we done it? And then, of course, eventually the news came through. Yeah, the whistle had gone in Doetinchem, the home of De Graafschap. And Ajax had failed to win, remarkably. And PSV were champions. And as you can imagine, quite a party then broke out.
A wonderful achievement for Philip Cocu to defend that title. Given the players that they lost last summer, Richard, arguably they're two best players. What do you think the reflection is on what Cocu has achieved this season?
Well, yeah, the recruitment has been good. There's no doubt about that. They lost Memphis Depay and Jorginho Wijnaldum. They're the two you're alluding to. And they had Karim Rekic on loan from Manchester City who finished that spell as well. So they had three holes to fill. Filled very nicely. Hector Moreno, the Mexican defender, came in and filled that left-sided centre-half position. He was an excellent signing coming in from Espanyol. And, of course, with Andres Guardado already being there, there was a bit of a Mexican feel. PSV fans had already sort of taken on a bit of a Mexican contingent trying to make Guardado feel at home to persuade him to sign. So Moreno came right into that. And it was, you know, there was a sombrero in the crowd yesterday. And, you know, you could kind of imagine that the PSV fans have sort of taken that on as an extra side to their personality. And then in terms of the other signings that they brought in, well, Davy Proper in the midfield has come in and replaced Wijnaldum. I think he's been absolutely brilliant from Vitesse. First season at a top club, first season in European football. He's been superb. Gaston Pereiro and Maxime Lestienne between them have kind of tried to cover for Depay. The Lacardi has had a good season as well. And with those three and Narsing, they've covered the two forward positions alongside De Jong, who's had a really good season. What Cocu's done is demonstrate his versatility, particularly in Europe. Because I was chatting to on air yesterday in the commentary. PSV, I think it's 96 games, 97 league games now without a 0-0 draw. So they play a lot of open games in the Eredivisie. But you can recall in Europe, you know, the Atletico Madrid games were both 0-0s. And he changed the formation and he proved tactical flexibility and helped the team compete. It helped the team compete at a higher level. And that's why I think a few of us felt actually PSV were the best team in the league this year. And we thought they might miss out on the last day. As it turns out they're champions and deserve champions as well.
Surely for Frank de Boer, who has been linked with via his own agent, Everton and Valencia this week. This is a massive blow for him as a coach to not claim that title. It's a bugbear for him, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean he's, you know, when he came in what was it, December of 2010, and he won the title that year, and then he won three more back-to-back, and he was the hottest thing really up and coming, and everybody was talking about De Boer, the next step, when was it going to be made? But the frustration that he had was that they hadn't made progress in Europe, and that Ajax had faltered in the group stage every time they'd been champions. Mm. They hadn't even got through the knockout stage, and he wanted to be able to prove himself as a coach on that level. He wanted to, you know, to make Ajax competitive, not perhaps necessarily in the way that they had been when he was playing for, when they won the trophy, but still in a way that took him back and proved himself as a coach at a higher level. And of course, what's happened since is that not only have they lost the title to PSV the last two seasons now, but that Philip Cocu has perhaps done what Frank de Boer was aiming to do and made a little bit of a mark on the European stage. So for de Boer, who is the longest serving coach in the Eredivisie now by quite a distance, I think it's decision time again, because they've got to play now. I actually got a finishing second means they've got to play two two-legged ties into the group stage. So even you know, you Champions League football in the group stage is by no means a formality. So
exactly.
What happens next, I'm not sure, but I don't think he's quite the attractive proposition maybe that he was 12, 18, 24 months ago.
Well, what we've talked about on the show before with the likes of Michael Jongsma and Peter McVitie, two Dutch journalists, Dutch football journalists, is that maybe he lacks versatility. And I wrote that word down because that was the very thing you said about Cocu, that maybe De Boer only has really one way of playing. Would that be harsh?
You know, I don't think it would be, to be honest, because I don't think they've proved themselves adaptable enough. They haven't really made a dent in Europe. I mean, the thing about Ajax is that the history of the club is that their methods, the passing, the pressing, the possession, have proved superior in the past. And I think Frank de Boer, at his heart, still believes that they can be. Now, whether this is a failing of the system or whether this is a failing of his ability to communicate to the players or whether it's a failure simply of the players, because the Eredivisie is not probably the league that it was 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. Certainly the results in Europe would show you that. And players get taken from the Netherlands that bit earlier than they used to. It's more difficult to build a team. He's gone through three and a half, four teams in the 5.5 years he's been there, Frank de Boer. So he's had to constantly adapt. Has he had the time with the same set of players to produce results, or has he simply failed to communicate and failed to adapt, failed to be more flexible? It's difficult to be exact, but I think it's certainly a valid argument that he hasn't shown it with the teams he's put out.
Richard, we'll let you get off to the tennis. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Richard. Really, really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Rob. All the best.
Okay, that's all we have time for on Football in Europe this week. If you have enjoyed the show, please leave us a review on iTunes and tweet us at FIE Podcast. We'll be back next Monday with Chris as well.
This is Football in Europe.